Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Third Stream View for Monday evening, July 16th. Man, I can't believe that we're halfway through this year already. But anyway, I am the mighty PK. I'm your host here at Third Stream View on BBSRadio.com every Monday evening. That's on BBSRadio.com, Station 2. And it's Third Stream View every Monday evening at 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. As always, I like to thank the suits in the office at BBSRadio.com for promoting and securing not only the great importance of alternative media, but free speech, First Amendment rights, freedom of expression. I would hope that the whole Bill of Rights, I think that the staff at this station are quite libertarian in scope, which is a good thing. And I am hoping to have a guest on tonight. He's been here before. And I contacted him earlier, and I got an email from him. But then when I called his number, I didn't seem to get through. I hope it's the same number, but he's been on here before. And hopefully I'll get him back on tonight. His name is Dr. Ray. I believe he was born in Syria, raised in Egypt, or born in Egypt, raised in Syria. He has a Christian background. But is very in tune to what's going on in the Middle East and has some insights. So I was going to explore some more of those, especially since the U.S. and Israel, probably Britain, are trying to provoke a war or more trouble with Syria, and they're trying to provoke trouble with Iran. What are we going to need now, another false flag so we can, you know, go to war with Iran? They have U.S. ships, a lot of U.S. ships over there stationed there, so that one of those can get maybe, attacked or shot at, regardless of how small the incident, so then they can try to turn it into another war. That's all the country needs, another war. So I here, as your humble host, if you don't know much about me, is that I cut to the chase. I critique things as I see them from a libertarian free market point of view. And of course, I'm always maintaining the ethics of liberty, wrapped up in a pretty good knowledge of the Austrian School of Economics. And although I am not an anarchist, I'm a minarchist. I believe in liberty, property, and peace, and micro government, micro taxes. I still believe that you can have a constitutional republic held back by a strictly adhered to constitution. Unlike the constitution we have today, that is, for example, for a lot of conservatives and Republicans, they support the constitution when they need it, when it appeals to them. But on other matters, they tend to ignore it, even if they say they're strict constitutionalists, especially in terms of foreign policy and torture. So that is a problem. And, of course, since the neocons have a lot to do with U.S. foreign policy, since they've infiltrated the Republican Party, and, of course, they're in the Democratic Party, too. Look at Hillary, making demands to Egypt or Syria, like they have to do this, they have to do that, as if it's, you know, as if who is the U.S. to dictate policy to these other countries? And it just shows you that the foreign policy stays the same regardless of who's in power. They try to say Obama's foreign policy is weak. Hell, he's been bombing more countries than Bush. He's expanded the wars. He still serves the Israeli lobby. The aid is still flowing to Israel, the free American aid, even though they say he's not that much of a friend of Israel. I mean, it's all there. He's still doing it. So I'm going to see if we can get my friend on here. And if not, I'm going to continue to wing it. I'm going to talk about a lot about foreign policy tonight, as I've been baiting some on the internet who say they are not neocons, but I wonder. We've been debating about the Navy and the sea lanes and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, I'm for a defense of the U.S. That's in the Constitution. But other sea lanes in other countries or other continents, I mean, that's the business of other countries and their navies and their military and their trade. Now, if U.S. shipping is interfered with or genuinely harassed or threatened or stolen from, well, then that would be a reason for the Navy to assist, but not to go picking fights, not to, police the world. I mean, Britain was already the world's policeman and it ruled the high seas and did quite well. So I don't think the U.S. is meant to emulate that, because Britain was an empire. That, I believe that was their manifest destiny, but it's not ours. Ours stopped at the Pacific Ocean. You know, so I'm all for armed neutrality. And protecting our country and our shorelines. That's what the Navy should be doing, not interfering over in the South China Sea in all these other countries where it doesn't seem necessary. It seems like our guest is with us. Dr. Ray, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am.
Welcome back. You're chuckling already. I haven't got to the funny bits yet.
Well, it's been a while since I haven't heard your voice, and to be quite honest, I'm a little pleased to hear it, so I'm chuckling, therefore, in happiness.
Well, thank you. I am usually a breath of fresh air in this world and universe. Now, before we start, would you care for some tea or coffee?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I have my own, and I'm very, very, very pleased with it, so I'm ready to talk.
Well, that's good, because it's self-service here. Now, thank you again for being available. I was a little worried earlier. I called and couldn't get through, but you did respond to my email, so I appreciate your availability coming back.
My absolute pleasure, indeed.
Now, let me refresh my listeners with, because you haven't been here in a while. Was it that you were born in Egypt and raised in Syria?
Correct.
Okay, I don't know if I had it backwards. And you have, even though you're raised in those countries, you have a Christian background.
Well, yes, born and raised Catholic, really.
So you would be a Syrian Christian.
Well, not exactly. I'm Lebanese by. You see, here's the thing. My father.
Okay, sorry, Lebanese. Right? You would be a Lebanese Christian.
My mom is Egyptian, and so when they fled the war, obviously they conceived me in Cairo, in Egypt, and so and I was raised throughout my childhood in Syria, and then of course moved back to our homeland, and here we are in America.
Now, which war was that? Was that the 67 war? Or the...
No, that was the 76 war.
You mean 73?
Well, yeah, it's subject to who you ask.
You mean the second Israeli-Egyptian war?
No. That was the Lebanese war when it broke out.
In 75?
75, 76, yeah.
When Israel bombed the hell out of Lebanon.
No, not exactly. It's when the Palestinians, here's the thing. The origins of the Lebanese war was Palestinian war with the Lebanese at the time.
It spilled over?
Well, it was over something very silly, to be honest. There used to be a political party by the name of the Kataib, and that translates to militias, if you will. And they had a parade, and a Palestinian bus wanted to go through the parade. Well, they didn't allow it, and then gunshots came out of nowhere, and they killed everybody on the bus. Of course, the Palestinians retaliated, and they attempted to invade, and they successfully did so. And ever since, that was the breakout of the original wars in Lebanon in the 70s. From there on, it blew up, and of course, we know the rest is history. But originally, the war in Lebanon was not, you know, it wasn't, how should one say, it wasn't Christian, Muslim, Sunni, Shiites, whatever. You know, it was straight up forward. It was, you know, people invading and, you know, the unity of a country trying to fight back. But, you know, we never had stereotyping, religious stereotyping in any way.
Well, I see now that the Syrian opposition wants Christians going to go back to Lebanon and the death to the Awala. There's another sect there.
Right. The Alawites are a direct descendant to the Shiites.
So they have a Muslim background.
Well, they're all Muslim. But the difference is the Shiites and the Alawites are pretty much the same. The only difference is minor details, however, versus the other Muslim, which is the Sunni. And those are the ones that, obviously, the opposition in this case. Now, remember, Syria is a very fragile country to begin with because the Alawites are the minority there, ruling over the majority. And that's exactly what this war is basically based upon, I think.
Well, this war is being greatly instigated by Mossad, CIA, and MI6, too.
Well, you have to understand, Syria, for a while, has been the biggest problem that Israel did not know how to deal with.
Right.
And so, you know, it was the only one that sort of carried the torch of the Palestinian case, as you say, you know. But other than that, somebody had to start something in Syria to actually bring down the system. Now, here's something really interesting. I'm not pro Assad. Neither am I against him, to be honest with you.
Me too.
I think the man is paying for his father's mistakes, you see. And really, the true blame, if you really come to think of it, is the Saudi. I would definitely say Saudi Arabia, because they're predominantly Sunni, and they don't get along very well with the Shiites. For a while, they've been exchanging words. They've been exchanging what we would say more of a bad blood that has gone long, and they wanted to somehow bring down the system, bring down the regime. And what they did was, obviously, they funded, you know, the supposed terrorist acts in Syria back in the early, say, last year when it first started. And the irony of it is that Israel is the one that proved it. That's the irony of it. We're not the one who's doing this. It's Saudi. Saudis are the ones who are doing this to you.
Yeah, but you know, yeah, of course, but Mossad is heavily involved too.
Well, you have to understand, they go very well hand in hand with Saudi Arabia.
There is an ironic cooperation between Israel and Saudi.
Indeed.
Now, Syria is primarily a Shiite country, isn't it?
No, primarily a Sunni. By numbers.
Really?
Yeah, Sunni is the majority.
Because
Shiites
it's close.
And Alawites are the extreme minority.
Because it's
and
a close
ally. By extreme minority, I mean they only have two or three towns, about, say, 2 million strong versus the rest of the 20 million that are Sunni. Yeah.
But Syria is a close ally to Iran, which is primarily Shiite.
Exactly. It's because the system, the regime itself, the Assad regime, is Alawite. And, and they're very, 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 very attached to they follow the Shiite sect, you see.
Uh-huh.
They're just, let's put it this way. It's a minor, like I said, it's a minor detail between the Alawites and Shiites. And by minor, I mean extreme minor. Therefore, they are technically Shiite.
Okay.
So, yeah. And, of course, because the Shiites are ruling the majority, the regime itself always has been a very good ally with Iran. And, you know, and it's rightfully so, because these two had sort of, they were tight-knit from the get-go. From the days of Hafez al-Assad, which is the father of the current President Bashar, the relations with Iran were very, very, very tight. And Iran fun, funded the Syrian the Syrian government for a while, funded them through money, through weapons, through oil, and of course, you know, don't forget that Syria for a while was suffering sanctions,
right?
And they somehow managed to overcome these sanctions by having the closest ally, and that was Iran. If it wasn't for Iran, Syria by now would most definitely would have been back in the Dark Ages. But Iran is the one that actually came to the rescue, along with Russia. You see,
I don't have a problem with Iran supporting its friend, its neighbors, or its friends. The U.S. is the arms merchant of the world. It does all this kind of stuff, and it has the hypocrisy to, you know, condemn these other countries. It's funny, Hillary telling these other countries, you know, like they're supposed to do this or that. You know, first of all, the Assad, the son, he's less of a prick than the father, as I understand it.
Much.
And you have, how would we like it in this country? You have, you know, you got his regime that's being opposed by foreign intervention, including U.S., propping up these the opposition, and whom we don't even know who they are. I mean, are they Al-Qaeda? Who are they? You know, it's more this mess like Libya. So, you know, obviously, I just want to stay out of it and let it solve its own problems.
That would be a very wise thing to do. But see, here's the disaster that we're looking at right now, and it's a little too obvious. Syria does not only play a key role in, you know, the politics in the Middle East. It plays a very key strategic game as well with Lebanon. It has very ties, very, very, very strong ties to Lebanon. For a while, the Lebanese were invaded by the Syrians, and supposedly, of course, under the umbrella of protection or peacekeeping, if you will. But that did not happen exactly. What the Syrians did, they ended up invading, indeed. And somebody had to support Hezbollah. And Hezbollah needed that link. And the link was Syria. Because between Iran and Syria, you know, they were already allies. And somebody had to supply Hezbollah somehow, one way or another. I mean, this is all common knowledge, in a sense, in the Middle East. Everyone knew. And everyone knows until today that Hezbollah has been funded by Iran via Syria, you see. And so that's why, really, the United States look at Syria as a terrorist country, per se, but not necessarily an active terrorist country. And in the light of what's happening recently, now they just accelerated the whole entire thing to a higher level. And they're saying, well, yeah, there you go. You know, terrorism does happen in Syria, and in fact, the regime is the terrorist, so therefore, you know, let's pin it on the man. Now, to say the least, I honestly think that the current president, he lacks political wit, if you will, because he's not a politician by origin. You know, he is, believe it or not, an optometrist.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and he's a wonderful man, believe it or not. Everybody who knows him on a personal level, they'll tell you he's an amazing guy. And what happened was, and this is fact, not fiction, the older brother, Basel, was being sculptured by his own father to become the next president. But Basel got into a car accident and died. Therefore, the next predecessor obviously would have to be Bashar. And so Bashar kind of, you know, was thrown to the lions really quickly. So handling what happened in Syria about a year ago was very, very poor. He could have done better than this. What he could have done is simply apologize, pin it on some sort of terrorism, which he did, but he did not apologize. He actually thought that the people are, you know, revolting, and he started, you know, fighting back, and that's what made him really look bad. But in reality, I don't think he knew how to handle it to begin with. Because if he would have done what he would have, I mean, I know I have a lot of Syrian friends who are part of the opposition, and they simply said the same thing, exactly, and they reaffirmed it. They said, well, you know what, if he would have just apologized for what happened at Daraa, it would have been over and done with. He would have ruled happily ever after.
Well,
none of this would have happened.
That may be. However, as I understand it, there are a lot of outside agent provocateurs in Syria now stirring up trouble and probably doing some of the killing and blaming it on Syrian forces. So, you know, it's an eternal problem for Syria that they need to work out, and the U.S. and Britain and Israel shouldn't be, you know, interfering. We wouldn't like it in our countries. Now, another irony, you mentioned Hezbollah. I thought that that Israel sort of helped nurture Hamas as a counterbalance to Hezbollah.
Correct, and that is simply because they're Sunni.
Hezbollah, but you don't hear much about that.
But see, that's exactly it. They're using their historical animosity in their own benefit. Let them duke it out. So what side are we going to pick? Well, obviously, Hezbollah is against us, so let's just support some Palestinians, the Sunni Palestinians, and train them, give them power, smarts, money, and you know, let them duke it out. let them work themselves out. And that was a very smart strategy on Israel. It's paying off, believe it or not. There is somebody who's holding up against Hezbollah and Palestinians themselves, who supposedly Hezbollah is fighting for their cause. They're being fought back by the Palestinians themselves, which is brilliant.
Well, it's just a sort of a historical mess. I wonder how it would have been if Britain and France never colonized the Middle East, as T.E. Lawrence pleaded for them not to do.
And that's exactly it. Lawrence of Arabia, he predicted all that because he lived in the Middle East for a while. He saw what the culture is, and he understands what, you know, religious culture and what can that bring. You see, Islam is not just a culture. It's not just a religion. It's not something that you go to a church or a mosque and then it's over and done with. It doesn't end there. It ends by the way you behave. It ends by the way you act. It ends, you know, you see, so there is a lot more to it than just believing in one God, praying to one God. It's also behavioral. So therefore, I believe Lawrence, he knew it. He saw that. He saw that very well indeed. And he predicted that there's a lot of radical Islamists that will come up should they colonize the Middle East. And that's exactly what happened. And the proof is in the pudding. The Islamist Brotherhood, it started simply and purely as a group to fight back imperialism and to push back the British out of Egypt back then. That is historically accurate. You see,
as I understand it, they're not what they used to be. They're not necessarily that bad of a bunch. The Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, not exactly, but see, the Muslim Brotherhood, it started purely as to fight imperialism. Simply as
right.
That, you know, let's get the British out of our country. It's simple as that. It had no particular message behind it. However,
they also want to have a Islamic country, or what do they call it? Islamic? Do they want Sharia law?
They want to implement Sharia. Yes, correct. They want to implement Sharia, but that came later, believe it or not. In the 50s and the 60s, radical Islamists took over the Islamist Brotherhood, and they started implementing Sharia law. You know, Egypt should be Islamic. Egypt should be following Sharia, and that's the end of that.
But, well, I don't have a problem with that. It's their country. You know, they can have what they want in their country. This country is different. I don't expect our, you know, and I don't have a lot of trust and faith in democracy anyway. I have two very narrow purposes of democracy. But those countries are what they are. They have centuries at what they are. And, you know, we can't enforce democracy at the point of a gun. And I have read Lawrence's dispatches from Iraq from 1920, 21. It's amazing what he wrote and what he saw. And so relevant, pertinent to today. So if they would listen to him, because he pleaded at the Versailles Treaty conference, he pleaded with the Allies not to colonize the Middle East. And I wonder if Britain and France had kept out. Of course, you know, Britain put a Saudi prince, and they created Iraq, put him on the Iraqi throne. I wondered, had that not have happened, a French-British colonization of the Middle East, including imposing Israel on Palestine, if we'd have had a much better situation today without all of that.
Well, it wouldn't have. To be honest with you, I don't think it would have changed anything, because radicalism is, and always have been, throughout the history of mankind. Be that as it may, if you want to go back centuries back, you can go back to the Crusades, for example. That's radicalism, if you think about it. But see, that's exactly it. It wouldn't have changed anything. The only difference that would have been is that these Arab countries, they would have ran themselves and killed themselves silly. Let's put it that way. So it wouldn't have changed much, really, I don't think. But to be honest with you, Lawrence of Arabia did notice this. Lawrence was brilliant. See, that's exactly it. He saw the whole thing firsthand, front row and center. And, you know, he knew exactly what would become should they colonize. And doing the colonization process, believe it or not, that sparked radicalism.
Oh, of course. So, believe it or not, that's not hard to believe at all. And Lawrence...
Well, yeah, but that's exactly it, you know. So he knew that that's going to happen. And, yeah, to wonder whether, you know, the colonies or the colonizers, if you will, would have thought it through? No, of course not. They didn't think it through. All they thought about was, well, you know what? Let's take the Middle East.
Empire.
Simple as that.
Well,
you know, much like they did to India, or much like they did to any other nation that they actually took over during the colony time.
True. But Lawrence did have this foresight, but the trouble was that his own government and military screwed him, because as he was trying to assure the Arabs that there would be no colonization after the war, they worked against him. They stuck him in the middle. They lied to him. So he found out later on, yet he had made these promises. So, you know, he labored with that all his life. It was a very bunch of guilt that he had to carry that he did not create, but he was thrown into.
Well, yeah. Lawrence was more or less a liaison. And he was used as a liaison, you know. Hey, could you connect us to these people? Sure. You know what? We promise you, we won't do anything to them. We just want to be talking to them. And we want to get to know them. Simple as that. And that's what he believed that that the Europeans are going to do. And the reality, there was a bigger agenda than that. And we all know what happened ever since then. I mean, but he was betrayed, yes, indeed. He was betrayed by his own government, by his own people. And, ever since, I remember reading his memoirs, he retired back into England, promised to himself that he will never, ever, and I mean ever, get involved in any sort of politics concerning local or, rather domestic and or international sort of relations at all. And he wanted nothing to do with it. He really did. Lawrence reminds me a lot of Colin Powell, believe it or not.
No.
Yes, he does. And allow me to tell you why. Colin Powell was lied to. Colin Powell was used to be put in the UN to read certain documents that he himself wasn't, believing. The weapons of mass destruction, he knew himself. There was no such thing as weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. He knew it. But the problem is, he was forced to say it. He was betrayed by his own government. And then when the Iraqi war started, if you recall, he resigned. He resigned his post.
I don't...
You see what I'm saying? So by the Bush administration, he was really betrayed.
I hear what you're saying, but I don't forgive him, and I think he should be one of many who should be tried and executed for what he did. He didn't research it enough. He could have spoke out. He resigned later. Maybe that took more courage to speak out than being under fire in Vietnam or somewhere else. But he's part of the problem with this whole mess. I couldn't believe that day I watched him with the vials and everything. I thought, what kind of BS is this?
But that's exactly it. He wasn't convinced doing it. Hence why he resigned his post. And if you recall, directly after he resigned his post, about a month later, he released his own book. And his book, believe it or not, and I read it twice, and I was really amused by it, to be honest with you, because the man, not necessarily justified what, his actions, but he was sort of forced to do things beyond his, his moral code. Hence why he predicted that Iraq might have a civil war, and it sure did. You see, so That's why he reminds me a lot of Lawrence, believe it or not. It's because he predicted the outcome, and he didn't like what happened to him. He didn't like to be forced documents on him that it didn't have any legitimacy at all, and he was speculative at best. So, it all comes down to the administration. I mean, if Colin doesn't do it, they'll fire him and get somebody else to do it. It's simple as that. And he understood that very well, but he was trying to play kind of safe in a way, and he wasn't so convinced in doing what he was doing, hence why he resigned. So, that again, but, there's a lot of similarities to Lawrence and him, I think, in my opinion. But, other than that, so it's nothing new, is what I'm saying. It's nothing new that a government lies to a person with some sort of moral, ethical code and use him as a liaison and making him look bad at the end of the day. But that's nothing.
Powell should have resigned sooner than if he had any integrity, he should have resigned sooner, and then he could have, said what he had to sooner. At this point, I forgot to mention that if any of my millions of listeners want to call in here and talk with us, the number is 888-429-5471. I'm talking with my friend, guest, Dr. Ray. I haven't talked to him for a while, but again, he was born in Egypt and raised in Syria, has a Catholic background, so he has a nice view of the Middle East, having lived there and knows the culture and the people. What was it like growing up in Syria? I mean, what age were you when you moved to the States?
I was 12 years old when I moved to the States.
Oh, 12 when you moved?
Yes, indeed. But I remember it very fondly, I tell you.
Did you grow up in Damascus?
No, in Aleppo.
Aleppo. Is that close to
the city of Aleppo, yes. And I'll tell you, if there's the best way to describe it, it was the most beautiful time of our lives. Until today, my parents would even say the same thing. In Aleppo, we had no problem with anybody. Nobody had any problem with anybody. It was simple. The rules were simple. Live and let live. It was simple as that. And it was most beautiful days ever in our lives.
A-L-E-P-O?
Yeah, no, actually, Aleppo. It's A-L-P-P-L-O.
A-L-P-P-L-O.
Yeah, Aleppo.
I'm thinking A-L-P-P-L-O?
Yes, I'm sorry. I forgot the L, yes, absolutely, you're right. But it is a double P.
Now, I need to spell this again. I want to look it up because I was thinking it was near the coast, but does Syria have any territory that borders on the Mediterranean?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
So it's not landlocked?
No, it's not landlocked. They have Tartus, they have Latakia, all these areas are directly on the Mediterranean Sea.
Okay, please spell Aleppo again.
A-L. E, I think, P, P, O.
I just want to look it up so I can see it while we're...
Absolutely. If you look it up on Google Earth, I always stare at it when remembering my old schools.
I'm having a look here. But it looks like... It's not near the coast, though, is it?
No, actually, it borders... It borders Turkey.
Right. That's what I see. Okay. So when you grew up there, where did you live? What kind of neighborhood? And did you have Muslim neighbors?
Yeah. I have plenty of Muslim neighbors.
You grew up with Shiites?
No. Well, mostly Sunni. Mostly Sunni.
Did you go to an American school?
I did go to a Catholic school there. Uh-huh. And... I grew up with nuns, of course.
Are your parents both, your mother, of course, your parents both speak fluent Arabic?
Indeed.
Does Syria speak Arabic?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
They're known, or they're famous for having the purest form of Arabic when it comes to education, the proper Arabic, if you want to learn proper Arabic. and Arabic culture, in a sense.
Oh, really?
You would, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I wasn't sure, because of their closeness with Iran, if they were Arabic country, because I am one of few Americans who know the difference between Shiite and Sunni and the, you know, the other cultures and da-da-da-da. So, right. So growing up there, was there any civil strife that you had to deal with? Was there any, you know?
No, actually, in Aleppo, we never had it. Never had a problem. Never had a religious differential. Never had a, you know, any kind of a difference at all. We were no different than any other citizen. We were
treated
much
smaller. Was there a small Christian community there?
I'm sorry?
Is there a small Christian community in Aleppo?
Oh, there actually there is a big one. Believe it or not, and they vary. Believe it or not, there is the Catholic, you know, Syrian Catholic. You have the Assyrians, which also are separate in a way, and then you have the Armenians. And that's the pretty much the you know, the Christian mix in Aleppo. And there's a very, very big community there. However, that it doesn't stop at Aleppo. It also there is a bigger community in Kesep. Which is also another neighboring town. There's also the Assyrians, which they call them Kildani, at the west side of the country. And, of course, in every major city there is a community of Christianity over there. Catholics and Christians in general, they, I believe, pose about 25% of the population in Syria.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Is there a small Jewish community in Syria?
To be honest with you, I never came across the Jewish community there, but from what I hear, that there is absolutely, yes.
Well, you know, Iraq had a small Jewish community and a small
yes,
Christian
so
community.
Yes, Syria. No, but
which,
see, here's the thing.
Which
no, I know
destroyed
they existed.
With war.
No, see, that, again, I know they existed. I never came across them myself, because from what I understand, the Jewish community was really, really big, or rather, it thrived properly in Damascus, in the main city. So, in the capital, rather. So, but I never came across them because, of course, we lived on the other side of town or the other side of the country. But personally, I've heard that there is a very big community there. Well, not necessarily very big, but fairly, you know, a big community there. And they're all Jewish. They're practicing Jewish, and you know, they're no different than any other citizen.
Well, to this day, Iran, mostly in Tehran, there are 25,000 Persian Jews living in Iran, and they're not threatened, and they're, you know, life goes
on
for them.
And 6 million Armenians.
They're not trying to get the hell out of Iran. There's 6 million Armenians in Iran?
Oh, absolutely.
Armenians?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Indeed.
I didn't know that. What, because they escaped Turkey?
Yes, indeed. They escaped, well, through the genocide, indeed, and they settled in Iran, and they actually have a big, very big community there. I know this because my mother, by origin, she is Armenian, and so, you know, coming across a lot of our family members and stuff, you know, a lot of them live out there, and they're very, very, you know, thriving community.
So your mother, although she was she born in Egypt?
No.
Okay, so she has thing. A Armenian Christian background?
And Libyan.
And is your dad American?
No, my father was Lebanese, purely.
Oh, okay. Okay. Christian Lebanese?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. There's a lot of Armenians in L.A.
Mm-hmm. And to be more specific, I'll tell you what we call a little Armenia. And that would be that would be bordering Pasadena. Pasadena also itself has a very big Armenian community in L.A. So yeah, Armenians are very very well good thriving citizens and community in
sure.
almost every lane that they go into. There's Armenians in Lebanon. And they're also a very big community. There's Armenians in Syria, also a big community. Armenians in Egypt, which is my mother is. Part of that community, and there's also Armenians in Iran and Iraq. So,
now you say there's about 6 million Armenians in Iran.
2 million.
2 million. Now, I thought Iran and Turkey hit it off quite well.
Well, whether they hit it off quite well or not, the reality is that there's, I mean, see, the way Iran is dealing with Turkey is Iran dealing with Turkey, not Armenian Iranians dealing with Turkey. You see how that works? So it's like, Armenians are welcome to stay here, but they have no say on our political agendas and so on and so forth.
Sure, I get that. And, what I meant was,
it's rightfully so.
But what I meant was, does Syria resent Iran? Sorry, does Turkey resent Iran for allowing all these Armenians to settle there?
I don't think it went that far. No, I don't think it went that far at all.
Why has there been such a problem with Armenians in Turkey? And are there still many Armenians living in Turkey?
Yes. Here's the thing. Now they lost their Armenian identity, of course, because they live in Turkey, so technically they're Turkish. But if you ask them themselves, well, what by origin, then they'll say, oh, no, we're Armenian. we're not Turks. But, well, there's a reason why. It happened in 1824, in April 24th. Turkey has invaded Armenia, killing 2 million Armenians in one night. And that is what we call the Armenian Genocide.
In 1824?
Every April 24th, you'll see a lot of Armenians hanging around the Turkish embassies around the world.
Why should I care when only Jewish suffering matters? Only Holocaust museums matter.
Well, that is something, because the Jewish community had more money to advertise itself.
In the media control. So, there's been millions of people in genocides in other countries, but they don't get museums and they don't get, reparations. And that is something that continues to bug me about this whole Holocaust thing. But what about, now back to Armenia, and is most Armenian names end with I-A-N?
Pretty much. Yeah. Or Y-A-N. It depends on who's from what, But yeah, the sound of Yun, in a way.
Are there any Armenian Muslims?
No, not that I heard of. However, obviously there was converts,
Sure.
Through the Turkish Empire back in the day,
Does Turkey not want to have like a independent Armenian state nearby or something like that? Or why don't they want the Kurds to have their own little country up there in the north of Iraq?
Well, the Kurds, that's another subject entirely. But I can tell you on the Armenian side, we have our independence. And Armenia is a very well-thriving country as of now. They suffered through recession, they suffered through communism, they suffered through a lot, and they actually balanced out. At the end of the day, Armenia is a very, very thriving country. However, when it comes to the Kurds, I don't know how to put it in the delicate words, but I guess they've been really screwed out of their lands. With the imperialistic, of course, takeover by the European, and that is, the colonization, they took over, that part of the world, and they gave some to Turkey, some to Iran, some to Iraq, and parts of Syria also as well. And that was supposedly Kurdistan back in the day, and they just left it at that. So the Kurds don't have an independent state right after the colonization of the Middle East. And that's, of course, thanks to the French and the British, much like you put it. So, that's exactly what the Kurd situation is as of now. They're kind of responding to, whatever happened to our rights. We had a country, we had a land, we had our own system and design and everything. And all of a sudden now we're just living in northern Iraq, most of us. And that's not enough.
Where was Kurdistan? Was it in northern Iraq, southern Turkey?
Yeah, exactly. It was in northern Iraq, parts of, it was actually a very big, mostly a kingdom, if you will, because it ran by a king. And that was Kurdistan. It was northern Iraq, parts of northern Syria as well, parts of southern Turkey, and parts of Iran, believe it or not, also. That it was that far. It was that big. It was a big, giant spot in the middle of the Middle East. And, the colonies did not like, the colonization system, rather, did not like the Kurds in any way, so they gave them no land at all. Hence why, Iraq looks kind of funny in that big, giant loop over at the top on the map, if you see it, that was all Kurdistan.
Are the Kurds mostly Muslim?
Yes.
But Saddam clashed with them, didn't he?
Yes, because the Kurds, what they wanted to do, they wanted to separate. They wanted to get that part of that land and make a Kurdistan all over again. Now, to him, that was a form of separatist, and he wanted to squash them really quickly. And back in 82, I'm not sure if it's 82 or 84, I remember, he used gas on them. He killed them via gas.
Yes, and he used weapons provided to him by the U.S., Britain, Russia, and NATO.
Well, whatever the case was, he named
them
terrorists.
But when they say he gassed his own people, where'd he get it from? Who was his suppliers?
Right, but technically they're not his people either. They're Kurds.
Say what?
That works. They're not his people. They're not Iraqis. They're Kurds. And all they wanted to do is get that piece of land back and bring back the Kurdistan,
Well, I'm very, very pro peaceful secession, but Saddam, like most leaders, they all believe in more centralization of power. I believe in decentralization of power.
Well, decentralized or centralized is not really the question here. Is that, to him, they were a bunch of terrorists, and he wanted to crush the opposition really quickly. And that's how he retaliated.
Well,
it was quite sad, to say the least. It was really, really quite sad. It was a massacre, and at a massive scale. So when you want to say weapons of mass destruction, I guess if you want to apply that to the gassing of the Kurds, then that would apply, I guess.
Well, again, this was done with weaponry supplied by the U.S. I still love, in the other countries, I love the footage of Rumsfeld meeting with Saddam in December 83. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. Not yet, anyway.
Yeah, it's a pretty popular clip. You see him meeting Saddam. They're shaking. They're shaking hands, and they're talking, doing their conferencing. And as I understand it, Reagan sent him over there to patch up things with Iraq. And then shortly after that, maybe right before the trip, Iraq was taken off the state-sponsored terror list. And then they were resupplied by the U.S. And this is during the Iraq-Iran war. Well, the Iran-Contra scandal pissed off Saddam, too, because as he was being, supplied and favored by the U.S. against Iran, when he found out that U.S. was selling weapons to Iran, too, he was furious. He saw that, once again, they're playing both sides of things. The U.S. and Israel were, supplying Iran also, so... Saddam thought, how dare they do this to me?
Right.
And I don't blame them.
And as a matter of fact, one can argue, and I don't know if it's true or not, but there was a rumor back in the 90s when he invaded Kuwait that he already got the blessings of the United States to invade Kuwait.
And that one diplomat said the U.S. had no position on that. However,
basically,
Kuwait used to be part of Iraqi territory.
Correct.
I don't know how long ago it split away. And Kuwait was slant drilling for oil into Iraqi territory.
Yes.
And not much was made out of
that. Not much
is
documented, yes. Yep.
But we got in that stupid Desert Storm War, which I, of course, opposed, so that, what these dictators could get back on their throne, Saudi, and the emir of Kuwait, something like with his 70 wives or whatever, could come back and, live it up.
To be honest with you, I'm not a, like, Kuwait is a very, very wealthy country. And it's not wealthy because, you know, they knew how to invest their money. No. It's simply because they had enough oil. And that's about it. That's exactly it. So, you know, and they have this sort of arrogant approach to the world. You know what? You don't like us? Guess what? We'll buy your friendship with our money.
And why not? The U.S., the federal government props up these emirs and these Arab dictators. That's another reason the U.S. is hated over there.
Well, yeah, obviously. But you see, that's exactly it. The Arab so-called spring, in my humble opinion, is not so much of a spring. It's actually more of a plot to weaken them even further.
I think so.
You know?
And I think it's heavily...
Don't get me wrong. I'm all pro-democracy, and I do agree with the concept of there should be a president that's been changed by the people every so often. You know, like the Assad regime, per se, you know, it's been over 30 years between him and his father. And that's a lot of time, you know, for one family to rule. I mean, you might as well change the constitution and call it a kingdom.
I've heard,
at least it's legitimate, you know.
I just heard last week, I forget where, but the dictator or the president, quote unquote, or the leader of Bahrain has been in power since 1960.
Yes, correct.
Now, the Queen, Her Majesty, the Queen's been in power 60 years this year, but it's more of a ceremonial, you know, constitutional monarchy, so she hasn't stirred up a lot of trouble.
Absolutely. But, you know, but that's exactly it. That's the problem in the Middle East. The Middle East, you know, the leaders of the Middle East, they've been the leaders for the Middle East, and they always will be the leaders for the Middle East. But see, now, with the Arab Spring is that supposedly that the idea or the ideals that democracy should happen and people have the right to vote for who they should lead to. I'm all for that, and I support that concept. It's all good and dandy. But then again, at what cost? You have to remember, some people are not ready for this. They're not, you know, democracy doesn't happen overnight, you see. And a democracy is a very expensive thing to have. By expensive, I mean, you know, what would you have to give to actually have somebody to represent you fairly? And that's the main question, really. That's exactly the problem. That's the disaster. But what, you know, Americans, in a sense, not to say that they're arrogant, they're not, but they're so used to a certain lifestyle. Well, you know, they're not. They're misinformed, I think. So,
they're both.
Well, yeah, but...
Arrogant and misinformed, and that makes it even worse.
No. I would really do not like to use the word arrogant at all, in any way. Because arrogance is not necessarily something that you choose, you see. You know.
Arrogance is when you keep shouting USA, USA, and meanwhile your country is steadily crumbling. And it's, you know, you're living on your laurels, and you've been led to believe that you're exceptional. And everything around you is starting to collapse, and unemployment, and da-da-da-da-da.
But, you know, that's all domestic. So, you know, you're talking on a domestic scale here. What I'm talking about, you know, arrogance in the sense of, like, okay, can I ask you something? This is a true story, and I see it every day. I deal with a lot of people from the international community on a daily routine. And, you know, one of them actually said something to me the other day that made me laugh. And I kind of find it funny because it does make sense. He says, you know, I've always been watching CNN all my life. And I always watch CNN International. And you guys, they bring news from all around the world. And it's beautiful. When I came to the U.S., I'm watching the same CNN as you guys are. And it doesn't bring half of the news that we normally get. Why is that? So my response to that was, you see, that's exactly it. The media does not allow Americans to actually know about other countries or whatever happens to other countries, or what, you know. So the news that's coming to us is super filtered, and I mean super, super filtered.
Of course.
If it doesn't involve the United States, it will not be aired. It's simple.
Well, yeah, but our media is heavily infiltrated by the CIA. And on this show, I call it like it is. The media is Zionist control. It's very pro-Zionist. It's very pro-Israel. That's what you have here in this country, as is Hollywood. So, you know, you're up against that. That's why, thank goodness for alternative news media, alternative radio, and the Internet.
That's exactly it. The Internet right now is the biggest revolution. And if you notice, the Supreme Court recently is trying to rule that revolution.
Oh, I know. They want to try to control the Internet, too. And, that, you know, I hate that. That's, you know, governments, they don't want that to stand. That's why I'm a fan of Julian Assange and a fan of Private or Bradley or whatever the poor young fellow's name is that they're treating like a dog, that he was a whistleblower. Bradley Manning, I think his name is.
Right.
It's a shame what's happening to these guys.
See, that's exactly it. You know, we pride ourselves of freedom of speech, and yet we don't practice it. That's the problem.
Oh, of course. And I like to say to conservatives, a lot of conservatives who say they're pro-constitutional or even pretty much constitutional, you know, absolutists, I tell them, yeah, you only support the Constitution when it suits you. When it's things that you get uncomfortable with, like our right to free speech when you don't like what we have to say, or the fact that the Constitution prohibits torture, you don't like those aspects of it.
Absolutely. You know, it's all about sculpture. If I can get it the way I want it, then that's perfect. And that's exactly what I hate to say it, but conservative America is really, you know, I don't want to say they're misinformed because they're not. They're just abusing the Constitution to their benefits and twisting it as they please.
They're very,
which is not unconstitutional, you know.
They're very misinformed as far as foreign policy goes.
Yes, indeed. Oh, yeah.
They can't tell a difference between a Sikh and a Muslim.
No, they can't. As far as they're concerned, they're all tower heads.
Yeah, they're all ragheads. You know, they're all, yeah, you know.
I heard that term on quite often. Yeah, you know, they're all tower heads. You know, they're all Yakistani.
There's reasons why this stuff happens and whatnot. But as I like to say, I'm an American who actually knows world geography and world history.
Well, that's a wonderful, amazing thing to do because you see
when I say that to people out of the country, I was in Europe last year. When I meet people, English speaking people, and we start talking a little bit, I'll tell them right off. I've even said to some, you know, you'll find this most amusing what I'm about to tell you when I say that I'm an American, you know, who knows these things. It's like a curtain comes down, and it's much easier for conversation because they have an apprehension about so many Americans are like clueless about things. When you talk to them, you got to kind of like not really walk on eggshells, but you don't want to.
You want to hurt their feeling.
Yeah, or contradict their, you know, absolutely, self-inflated worth.
Absolutely, and so that's exactly what I mean when I deal with, lately I've been dealing with a lot of what Americans would call foreigners. And to be honest with you, these people are most diplomats, and they're very good people, and I deal with them on a daily routine. And let me tell you, they look at us in a very, very funny light. It's like, do you know where I'm from, really? You know, have you ever seen it on the map? You know, they want to say that, but they don't want to offend that person. So it's kind of funny, you know.
When I pick up on that, I push the conversation further, and I'll say, like, you know, I'm an American who actually knows that the rest of the world knows more about America than America knows about the world and even about itself, and they really like that.
Absolutely.
I've had deep conversations with people over the years.
But you see, that's exactly it. Where do we change this, or how do we change it? In my opinion, it's very simple. It's called education. Let's start educating the people. Let's start educating the kids. Something more of international geography.
Well, that's true. However, since the state controls education, you get indoctrinated by statism, and you get these fairy tale history books of what went on and this and that. And of course, you know, the winner always writes the history. So, you know, a lot of what I learned was BS. It's taken me my own research, thank goodness for the internet and elsewhere, to point myself in these directions because I'm largely self-educated. But I've read books by the greats and the standing on the shoulders of giants that I like, economists and whatnot. So, you know, I'm a lot different than the – I don't have a lot in common with a lot of Americans. I have much more in common with people who have traveled outside of the country.
Well, there you go. See, traveling is what also helped you out a lot, you know, because when you travel, you get to learn cultures and you get to see people and you get to see that, you know, that there's far more to it than just what you hear on the news or see, you know, or you know what I mean? So I honestly encourage Americans to travel more.
Oh, yeah. Hell yes. But see,
because,
a lot
know, when
of
you
Americans...
travel, you get to learn other people and you get to learn their culture. You get to learn where they're from. You get to learn everything about them. And, you know, and there's no better way to learn it than that way. Because now you're there. You're there. You're right in front of them.
But a lot of Americans, and they're waking up to the fact that, you know, the world doesn't revolve around America. Hence, foreign competition, foreign products, jobs going overseas, this and that. You know, this whole thing is changing.
Well, absolutely.
But I get it.
Well, see, there's a reason why Americans are beginning to, how should one say, wake up, in a sense. It's a bit of a late wake-up call, to be honest. But you
True.
Know what? It also plays a very important role. And as far as I see it, the role here is that how do you teach somebody that never was taught, you know, how to deal with international policies and international ways of dealing with things. And you know, you can't. You just can't. So the best way to do it is simplify it. You know? And that's exactly what it's all about. It's simplification. You know, Americans need to have everything simplified to them. And that's the key. You know? That's exactly
Yeah, but
the
that's
key.
Pretty sad, isn't it?
It is, but you know what? It's been like that for years. So you're not going to change the world all in one day. And you're not going to change the whole society in one day either. So, you know, you have to sort of compromise to a certain degree.
What I like to say to that is, how come Americans don't know that? We say we're exceptional. Which one is it? It's just like this. I've kind of pissed off these couple conservatives, but I gave them their own rope to hang themselves. You know, they send me these, you know, this crap, these emails about Obama being a Muslim. I said, hey, you neocons, you got to make up your mind. Is he a Christian or a Muslim? He spent 20 years in Reverend Wright's church. Which one is he? And they didn't like that. And they didn't have an answer.
Which is my point exactly.
But it was you hilarious. Know, which one is he?
It's all hyped up propaganda. So, you know, he's a terrorist. He's a communist. He's a socialist. Well, which one is he?
he is a what I would call a left-wing corporate socialist, and Romney is a right-wing corporate socialist. They're pretty much both the same. They want a bigger military budget, expand the wars. They support Gitmo. They support the Patriot Act, and they support that awful Military Detentions Act and the drone attacks. And I knew that these drones were going to come back and haunt us, and they're in our own country, and I knew they would be.
Well, you know, it's sad, it really is. But the reality is, right now it's at our doorstep. Let's face it, it's our own creation, you know, and we got to deal with it. We got to deal with it one way or another.
Wait, what is our own creation?
These drones.
It's not my creation. It's what the government has done, and they're
no,
going to use.
No, but that's exactly
it,
what I mean. You know, as a,
but they're
going
to use it
on a governmental
us.
Sort of. You know,
but
I'm talking on a governmental sort of way, and you know that's exactly it. You know, this is our country's creation. We made our bed and we got to lay in it. I think.
Yeah, but they're going to use those bastards, damn things against us. And I am hoping that through technology we can soon have handheld or whatever things to take these damn. Drones out or to jam them, because they're going to start using them against us. Then they'll pass laws where any interruption, anybody trying to interrupt a drone or something will be prosecuted and sent to jail. I mean, I see that happening.
Well, you know, it already happened with the helicopter. Has it not?
You mean the Black Hawk helicopters?
No, generally speaking, helicopters. There's helicopters that are flying all over. And was to say they're not listening to anything and everything we're talking about.
Well, that's a problem, too. But, however, the drones can even be handheld. I mean, they could maybe go down your fireplace or go through your window. I mean, they're real small. And that's a very scary thing.
You know, nanotechnology is scary.
Well, I don't think it's scary. I don't think it's scary if it's used for medical technology to improve this or that. But
you can make an epidemic of it.
Say what?
Yeah. You can use it as a weapon as well.
Well, they are, and spying and everything. All the police departments want drones. I mean, it's awful what's happening.
I agree. Drones are a dangerous thought, and let's just hope it doesn't go bigger than it already is.
Well, I'm not too optimistic about that, or the economy, the foreign policy. It just seems more of the same. And so that's why, since my man Ron Paul is kind of out of the scene, I'm going to support the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, who doesn't want war with Iran, who vetoed a lot of bills in his own state. He's a good guy, actually. So that's where my vote's going to be, because I can't stand the other two. I didn't vote in 08 because I couldn't stand Obama and I couldn't stand McCain.
You know what? In my opinion, to vote is not to vote. It sounds anti-democratic, but it is. To vote is not to vote, and it doesn't matter whether you vote or not. Because let's face it, whatever you decide on doing ain't going to change anything.
That's pretty correct. So that way I have to vote my conscience, and it's not going to be for more government. It's not going to be more of these interventionist, warmongering, big government types. So that's why the foreign policy stays the same no matter who's in office.
Right. So, you know, in my opinion, whether we vote or not vote, it's not going to change much. You know,
yeah.
The foreign policy is the same. It's much like you put it, it's a Zionistic system, and that's the end of that.
Well, I think it's sad but true, Dr. Ray. So I must say that with that, I am going to thank you for coming on. We're winding down here. I'd like to have you back again on soon, because I like your take on things. And, of course, having been born and raised in your teen years in the Middle East, you have that extra take on things, and you actually know world geography.
Come on, believe me.
You actually know world geography and world history. So with that, I am going to say goodbye for now, because it's time for me to sign off here. But again, thanks to my guest, Dr. Ray, who I'm glad to have back on. It's been a while since he's been back, but we thank you for coming back on. So I'm going to say goodbye now, folks. This is your host, PK. I'm here every Monday evening on bbsradio.com, Station 2, 8:55 Pacific, 10:55 Central, 11:55 Eastern. Good night, everyone. Soon the time